All righty, let's jump right in. So we've been learning a ton about fellowship in general. I just want to hit some things that we're going to hit in a future time before we do a deep dive today on something that's known as core drivers. One of the things that fellowship is about is it's really about sharing. And it's a lot of it has to do with sharing from God's word, what we're learning, sharing material possessions. We see a ton of examples of that in Scripture. We also see it about sharing our lives and being able to go deeper with people and, in a sense, act as kind of healing agents, for lack of a better way to say it, to one another. So obviously, we took the tact of starting with the healing side first, because oftentimes, if we can get to know people and know what they're about, it makes the other parts a heck of a lot easier to do. And today, in particular, is something that it's going to be really deep as far as the concept that we're after, that has to do with what drives us. Because we're going to learn today that if we can identify what drives someone, we can almost predict what they're going to struggle with as far as their own sin issues. We're going to know how to apply the gospel right where they are and be able to show them how the gospel meets what drives them in a way that they may not have thought of before. And it's a great way to kind of get people to move away from where they are with that. So we're going to stick with our same themes, with all of our issues, all the sin struggles that we have. Everything is rooted in idolatry. And we know that the answer to this idolatry is always Christ. And once again, we've been told over and over again, the lie is that we can do it alone. So we don't really share with anybody what's really going on at a heart level. We try to do it on our own. And unfortunately, the reality is the way God designed us is we actually need other believers in order to move through that sanctification process. So we really can't do it alone. Last time we talked about being blind to our own sin. And one of the things that we talked about is what we're supposed to do is experience worship, waiting on, hoping in God and his goodness. And we're supposed to kind of be focused there. But what sin especially gets us to do is it gets us to not acknowledge God. And we talked about how basically what sin does is it says that we have the right to judge him or his word and or his word. And then we want to go after the things that most matter to us. Security, love, acceptance, value, enjoyment, significance are things that are going on at a core level that we're really after. And then once we kind of decide we can judge them and get things the way we want to get them, it typically takes an aggressive means like yelling, gossiping, arrogance, or a protective means, worrying, amassing wealth, doing something else like people pleasing or things like that. The idea is we're looking for substitutes because we have just pushed God out of our life and have come temporarily to believe that he's not good. We said that often we focus too much on the fruit of the sin, the actual behaviors. What we really need to do is focus way earlier. Because if we're focusing in on the fruit, it's kind of like picking a piece of fruit off a tree. It's going to grow back on that tree. Or if it's a new fruit, it's going to be just as bad as the fruit you just picked off. So it's not going to do that much for you. You got to get to the root. And the root in Romans 1 talks about that we fail to acknowledge God, we fail to praise him and thank him, and then we try to get what really matters to us. So I've been doing counseling or some form of helping relationships for 29 years, and it's crazy being doing work on the counseling side, which typically has to do with healing, and then also doing work with organizations and companies, which typically has to do with growth. And what's crazy is when you watch both sides, whether it's healing or it's growth, you see the same theme show up over and over and over and over again. It just doesn't matter where. You start realizing that people are basically driven to one of six things. And so this is something that I came up with years ago, and I would love it if you guys found anything outside of these things to let me know, because a client of mine asked me to write an ebook on it. And Megan and I are going to start doing that. So if you see any exceptions, I really do want to know. But it's just something that I use over and over again with clients that helps us identify what's going on at a deeper issue. And so as you can see, the core drivers are security, love, acceptance, value, enjoyment, or significance. And if we take the first letter from each one, it spells out slaves. And we are a slave to our drivers. Now, if you look at this list, as I hinted at last time, all of it's good. In its proper place, it's all good. All of it is something the gospel provides. The gospel gives us security, love, acceptance, value, enjoyment, and significance. It's good stuff. The problem is that sin tries to elevate one of these six things to be the thing that we need in our life. And once it gets elevated above God, it creates a heck of a lot of problems for us. Everything starts to break down. And so when we're talking to people at church and moving into these deeper relationships of closeness, sometimes somebody wants to talk about a particular sin they have. And they're just going to talk about this one sin. But oftentimes what we don't realize is that they could be pursuing that same sin for a totally different reason. 50% of the teams that we work with on the organizational effectiveness side of my company are sales teams. And everybody thinks, you know, what motivates a salesperson? Everybody says, money. That's right. The reality is it's not money. The reality is it's what money represents to them. And as you could see from this list, money can represent any one of these six things to them. For some of my sales guys, it's all about get security. They want to amass a whole bunch of money and never have to worry about it again. And so they're fantastic salespeople, but hoarders. For some people, it's about love. If I have all the money in the world, people are going to love me. I got the bling. Are you kidding me? Gotta love me then. For some people, it's acceptance. If I have money, boy, I can get into that ritzy club, and I'm now it. I'm at that status now. And so money for them is about accepting, being accepted or belonging. For some people, it's about value or worth. If I have more money, I've got a lot of worth. I'm special. I'm more special than you even, because I got more than you. Heaven forbid somebody walks into the room like Elon Musk, who, you know, obviously dwarfs everybody in this room combined. That person's in trouble, but that's what they go for. For some, it's enjoyment. I want money because I want the toys. Give me all the, you know, fantastic cars and gadgets and watches and TVs and this and that. And for some, money is really about significance. I am somebody because I've got money. So as we could see, the same item can be used in any of these six ways. What we need to do if we're going to help our brothers and sisters out to really grow, to really move through sanctification, is we need to help them out, we need to help ourselves out to know which of these six things is really driving us. If we can figure that out, let's say somebody comes to you and says, I really have issues with money, and I'm really scared of losing it, et cetera, et cetera. What we know is once we get to the root of it, it's going to knock out a bunch of things at the same time once we deal with it, not just that money issue. And that's typically when we know we've got it. Because they'll say, oh, wow, I no longer struggle with this, this, or this, not just this thing. There's a few things that got knocked out because they were all based towards the same idol. Does that make sense? Okay. Now let's go into a little bit more detail on each one so we can understand what it looks like when somebody's pursuing it. Literally, please see where you are in this. It's not a bad thing if you see yourself here. It's one of the ways we can fight for each other to not let our idols have control of us, is by identifying it, seeing it, so it's not just being a cancer that's working under the scenes. It's actually now exposed. Typically what we find, if security is your core driver, is oftentimes it takes place, especially with money and amassing money, seeing money as your way of having security or safety. Often it shows up with social power or even like physical safety. Just the rules you set for you and the kids, different things like that. It all becomes like a bigger deal. And so your life just becomes around getting security. What we typically also find paired with this one is usually the person struggling with fear and anxiety. So if we're looking more on the surface, what we're going to hear them say is, I'm really anxious. I'm anxious a lot. And oftentimes that's a tip that they might be dealing with an issue with security, especially when they start to describe it. And you start seeing that the way they describe the loss of money or the loss of social power or the, you know, somebody being able to, somebody breaking in their neighborhood and they're unusually, inordinately scared about it. There's this sense that we know it's probably a security issue because typically whenever it's threatened, our emotions spike way higher in any of these letters. And that's a way that we also know that we can discover which it is. So oftentimes what somebody, when they struggle with security, sometimes they do try to form this like protective bubble with whatever is theirs, almost like a force field that they want to put around themselves and those that they love. Now, if love is a big deal, what we know is that oftentimes people who struggle or who move love to the level of an idol are typically dealing with emotional intensity. Typically, the way they kind of come on you is strong. And this even happens with same-sex friendships. Like, some guys will just feel like, wow, this guy's like all of a sudden on me like white on rice, you know, and it's just a little too tight. If it's somebody romantically that's being pursued, the person's often like, hey, leave a little room for the Holy Spirit. I mean, this is like, you're coming on way too strong here, right? And it's like a little freaky. I'm guilty of this one. So I think I know this one the most. Before my wife, you can ask anybody I dated previously, and they would say, this guy came on hard and fast, and they just attributed it to me being Dominican. No, it's the love idol. It's not a Dominican thing. It's more this. Oftentimes what we see is that there's just this clinginess or this stronger sense of, I've got to have you. And so if you notice, it's not really about love. It's more about possession. But the person thinks it's love, right? So we want to just look at it as all of our idols, when they move to that level, stop being about the main thing. Now, what often happens is an anxiety shows up here that has to do with expectations. Sometimes we'll see it with an extreme jealousy. So I'm working with I'm doing some pre-engagement counseling for a couple. And one of the things that you could just see on the guy is he's so threatened by any guy that looks at his girl. And you're like, you live in a major city. If she goes outside, I am so sorry. It's always going to happen. And so he spends most of the day super worried. Who looked at her? Who didn't look at her? And she's like, hey, chill, little space. I'm cool, you know? And sometimes that intensity can kind of move into a place where somebody starts feeling like everything's a threat to whatever the object of love is. And so sometimes this love idol, it'll especially spike if someone feels like the other person isn't returning the intensity of emotions that they're pushing on. And so they kind of fall apart. They need that intensity coming back to feel okay or to believe that they're loved, even though that's not loved. And so what winds up happening for many of these people is that they try to make themselves whatever the other person wants them to be. So they kind of lose themselves in the person. And that kind of just keeps moving things further and further and further, and then they beat themselves up when they're not ideal, and it just kind of spins on itself. Let's look at acceptance. If acceptance is your core driver, typically we need to be that indispensable person. We need to be the one that everybody wants in their group. That first one chosen sometimes could be a sign of it. But it's more about the exclusivity of the group. The more exclusive, the harder it is to get in, the more that person probably is struggling with an idol of acceptance. And oftentimes what we see is they really try to like get into relationships from a position of power. And one of the ways that they feel like they have power or they've reached it is if people are either opening up secrets. Typically, these secrets aren't emotional secrets. It's more tangible than that, typically, but it can be. The idea is that they want to be let in, and they want to be let in at a high level. So if somebody comes in and they're kind of more popular than they are or something along that line, their anxiety picks up right there. On that person getting accepted more than they are. Now they're starting to view themselves as not being indispensable. This other person is. And that's a threat. And so they often, like, you know, struggle with fears of abandonment, betrayal. It can be condescending. Sometimes they give in to slander and gossip as a way of trying to, like, make themselves more important or kind of look better, right? And so these are just themes that we can kind of see. And so what winds up happening is that they usually try to find ways to literally secure their position. And so if it's a social group, they love being the president and they stay right there. They want to run every single year and be president because you can't kick the president out. And that's just kind of where they like to stay. Value. If value is your core driver, typically you're looking for ways to prove you're worthy. And one of the ways you prove you're worthy is by your accomplishments, by your achievements. What did you do that's more special than anybody else? That valedictorian position now is all of a sudden like a big deal, right? It's nobody else has got that but me. I must be worth it. It's about sometimes they can go into like being very pious or appearing very pious. And when they appear that way, it's kind of that holier than thou righteousness that can kind of come in as a way of trying to get that. And so oftentimes when their anxiety spikes and when you'll notice that they move that way is when they suddenly feel like they haven't met a standard. So it could be a relational standard, but often it might show up with academics or work or something like that. They usually struggle with failure. And all of us, obviously, in the room struggle with failure to some degree, but usually what we're talking about is something way more inordinate, something way bigger, and that's how you could spot it. It's like, wow, that's a strong reaction to that. And when you hear yourself say that, you typically know you're in an area of somebody's idol. And so oftentimes, they try to stay really relevant. They try to be super useful, indispensable that way. They try to make sure that they're needed. They want to make sure that they have something on you. So it's not about two people just being with each other. It's not even about letting the other person choose you. That's too risky. I got to force you to want me. And I'm going to give you X. And if I give you X, you're never going to leave me. So once again, if we're talking about at the level of idols, it stops being about what it truly is, what the word value truly means. It's much more of this kind of different form of possession. Enjoyment. If this is your big idol, you typically notice big life themes in the person. So I typically know it. My office is on the first floor, and there's like this parking lot. That's right outside my window. And so I can like see out when my clients drive in if they come in. And typically they drive the best cars. It's kind of like, you know, it's them. The Maserati just arrived. And it's just like, wow, you know, it's like this incredible, gorgeous thing, right? And so for them, it's all about things like vacation or the food, or even sometimes if they're sinning with drugs or luxuries, but it's often about toys and gadgets. Like these guys seem to be like the early adopters of almost everything. And that's something that really drives them. It means something to them. And so what typically happens for them is if life starts becoming boring or slow, they do something to amp up the adrenaline. It's either a self-sabotage where it's like kaboom, and like now the adrenaline's really high. Or they go out and they buy some yacht somewhere or something like that. I mean, it's just something. So I had a client who, how do I not say enough identifying information that you can't know who he is? But at the same time, okay, got it. So this is what this guy did. So this guy, what he did was he bought a Porsche 911 Turbo and he drove it for a week. And then after he saw the Porsche 911, after he drove it for a week, Tesla came out with the Plaid, and he was one of the first guys to get the Plaid. He had it on reserve from I don't know how long ago, and it finally arrived. He drove that for 2 weeks. That one lasted 2 weeks. And then he saw this like incredibly gorgeous like Bugatti, and he said, I gotta have one of those. And so he bought that for a week. And it just, his wife said that it's like every week there's this new huge toy that's so expensive. And now think about selling it, right? If you buy it for like full price and you just drive it off the lot, it's already lost a ton of value. So it's constantly losing value, but it doesn't matter. It's about the enjoyment. It's about the toys. She describes his house as a museum to technology. I mean, it's every gadget this, a remote control for that. I mean, it's like he could do everything from his phone. I mean, they can be like in Tahiti and take care of everything in their house, basically. And it's just the way he's got it wired up. And so for them, typically it's about the good time, keeping the adrenaline up, lots of toys, lots of those kinds of things. And so often it's about hedonistic pleasures and the freedom to do whatever you want when you want to do it. It's like no stopping it. That's what it's typically about. And what's crazy to me is this is even true of those people who don't have a lot of money. So sometimes you'll see that they live way beyond their means. It's not even beyond their means. It's like way beyond their means. And when you figure out how did they get there, you just have to go to their house. And you'll see like all these expensive gadgets and you just wonder how they're doing it. You know, the latest iPhone, like what is that, like $1,000 or $1,200 these days, they would get it on the spot, even though they may make only $400 a week or something. It's just what they do. And that's typically how you know it. Now, significance, if significance is your core driver, typically you're wanting to be the top dog all the time. So fame, status, popularity, how many likes did I get on Facebook? Like all of these things tend to mean everything to you. And if somebody got more likes for posting the same meme, heaven forbid you're that other person because he's coming after you, right? It's usually something along that line. It's usually an obsession with how they're viewed when it gets to an idol level. It's usually like they just want to be seen as the best of the best. And if anybody threatens it, oh my goodness, good luck. Good luck. Because they'll want to take you out. And so that's often what we see when it gets to that higher level. So when does fear and anxiety come from them? Typically, it comes from them when somebody enters the room and they're more significant than they are. Just somebody has to just enter the room. And you'll see this fear spike that often looks like anger if it's men. Just so that you know, sometimes the way we men show anxiety isn't through being scared, it's through anger. And so sometimes that's how we know that somebody's struggling with this. And so the whole idea is that they want to make sure that they're always making a difference, but the difference isn't necessarily in a good way, like in the way that God would have wanted it. Everybody has a call, so making a difference means you fulfill your call. You're really significant. You're already significant because Christ saved you, and you're a child of the King. This is way more about like proving it in a tangible, material way. And so it takes on a whole different animal. Now, if you're into significance, typically you're always looking to be high on the social status, high up. And you're always looking to make yourself more important, indispensable, sometimes in similar ways to acceptance, except they're not really interested in belonging. They just want to be on top. It's not about belonging. It's about being on top. That's more important. All right. Now, one of the interesting things that we sometimes find is the way you can also see a core driver is by the way somebody pushes against the core driver they want so badly. And sometimes what they do is they sabotage it because they don't feel like they're getting enough of it. So there's all these denial habits that happen. So you would think somebody who is into security would never live recklessly. But oftentimes, once they're kind of in a place where they feel like that security's been threatened enough, they can swing the other way for a while. And suddenly it's way more reckless living, no cares about attachments, you know, kind of purposeful destruction. If it's love, sometimes you'll know it because the way they push against it is by saying, I don't need anybody. And they try to convince themselves that they don't need anybody. And they try to be that hermit. except it doesn't really work. Eventually, they're going to swing back the other way. Sometimes the acceptance tries to go the lone wolf way, and they kind of move in a different direction. They become super unreliable, which is also a typical one, because they're always disappointing somebody, which is the opposite of that idol. And they're kind of moving into aggressive or self-sabotage kind of ways. With value, sometimes they start giving up. They just don't see meaning in their life. And so what winds up happening here is that the way they push against value, and you know that value is a core idol for them, is that they don't have any goals or desires. You really see a lot of laziness. They're apathetic. They don't want to go anywhere. Enjoyment, sometimes they've just become super disciplined, super routined, kind of almost self-flagellatingly punishing themselves, which once again looks like the opposite. Significance, typically somebody who's pushing against it is now become a martyr. You know, they're really kind of way more about like them being a victim. And they talk about them being a victim. So if somebody came in who's more significant than them, they're a victim to that other person. The other person may not have done anything except enter the room, but that's the way it's going to come across. And mind you, we've all got these things. So sometimes what we got to see is that these denial habits, since they're still oriented around a core driver, typically one core driver, that's how we typically know it's there. So how do we discover ours? So some people sometimes ask me, do we only have one core driver? And usually, yes. Usually it's just one at a time, but usually there's a couple others that are hanging close, right? And sometimes we have to kind of eliminate the other ones in order to get to the one that really seems like maybe too strong in us. Oh, I forgot to say that we've got a handout on all the tables that keeps forgetting to say that every single week, that you could follow along with and take home, that has some of these things here. So what do we do, or what do I try to do in sessions with people to help them see their core drivers, or help me discover their core drivers and then address it? First thing is really look at their story. What's really driven them across their life? And typically what we see is the pattern shows up over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And then what we want to look at is their motivations. Why do they get out of bed? What are they after? What's their dream? What are they going for? Why are they going for it? We want to look for memories of when they went through intense pride and humiliation. Because oftentimes, if we find out why they felt so humiliated or why they were so prideful, often we'll see the idol hiding in there. So we're looking at what was the root of those moments, or why did they feel so amazingly good? Sometimes it's legit and it's good stuff. So I don't want to make it sound like if we have a really great success and we're cheering that there's something wrong with that. There really isn't. We're just once again talking about when it gets inordinate. This one is typically the one that shows it the most for me, or for what I'm looking for, is what really stresses you out. When do your emotions get inordinately intense? What's going on? And so typically when we look at what stresses us, we could see it. And oftentimes, we're able to spot somebody else getting too stressed out over something, but we don't really spot ourselves getting when we're too stressed out over something, because it feels natural and normal, which is part of why we need friends and deeper people. When I was a financial consultant with Merrill Lynch, and I was able to see what people spent money on, oh my goodness, does it show up here. Boy, does it show up here. Typically, you could see somebody's idol by what they do, especially with disposable income. So not just mortgage, things like that, or whatever. Or sometimes you could even see it that way. If it's enjoyment, it's way above their means. Sometimes it's that, but that could mean a bunch of different things too. But where do they kind of spend the most? What really means something to them? Sometimes that really tells us a lot of what's going on at a heart level. All right, now we're going to jump into groups of three again. Once again, let's not have families together. Let's be with somebody else. You can go as deep as you want or not as deep as you want. That's totally cool. But what we want to do is we want to choose one of these questions, and let's discuss it. Let's each person take 2 minutes to answer one of these six questions. One of these four questions. So just take 2 minutes each, break into groups of threes. Let's get going, and then I'm going to wrap us up by showing us a little bit something more. So go for it now, and no family members together. All righty. Let's start talking about this. So first, I know we walked through this kind of fast. I know that we move quickly. I am trying to set something up for you guys. So let's just start with, what questions, if any, do you have? Yes. I love it. So the question is how do we know if we've gone from a fallen weakness to the level of an idol? Typically, the way we know it is by the level of obsession on it. And that's typically the way we know. So a way that typically somebody who's in session with me is I notice it more by the intensity of the emotion around it. If they're more intense, then they're typically probably closer to that stage of an idol. Remember, all six of those things are good things. They're not bad things. It's usually just when we pushed it too far, it starts doing something really different. It's no longer good. So it's kind of like, I have to have worth or else I'm nothing. And often that's when we see it. So what happens when somebody's threatened with a loss of it? Do they really just fall apart? Or are they kind of bummed and hurt, but they kind of get over it? Typically it's the degree. Great question. Yes.
So when I hear you talk, I hear the extremes in it.
Yeah.
Right? But there's a gradual progression.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And I'm like going, I think I'm the frog in the kettle.
Yeah, there we go. That's right. We all are. We all are that frog in the kettle.
And the hard part is figuring out where you are.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's hard for us to see our own stuff, right? So that's why we talked about sin blinding us. And that's one of the major arguments why I want to say that we cannot do the Christian life alone. Because we're blind. We're in a blind spot. It doesn't look as bad to us when we're giving into it as it would look to a fellow brother and sister who does not struggle with the same idol. They would see it as, whoa, alarms are going off in them. For us, it's a Wednesday. I mean, right? So the idea is that I usually don't try to fully evaluate just to kind of help that out. I'm usually more trying to figure out, am I in line with Christ? Do I see those six things as gifts from him, or do I see them as replacements for him? If I see them as replacements for him, I must have love no matter what. Not a good sign that I'm keeping it under the gospel. More of a sign that it's a replacement. Great question. What else we got? Yeah.
I've been wrestling a little bit with the kind of distinction between value and significance.
Great. So what's the difference between value and significance? That's a great one. So as I said, some of these kind of touch close, and that's definitely a pair that does. So when we think about worth versus when we think about being on top, they can have two different meanings to the person. So being on top is almost like a super worth, if you want to look at it that way. But typically, it's not even so much about... It's almost like I have to be the best no matter what. And I don't necessarily derive a value from it except to say I'm the best. Whereas worth typically has to do with like my being. Am I worthwhile? Am I valuable? Do I mean something? Like it's usually more moving that way. So significance best, worth is usually more being. So significance way more accomplishments. Worth way more about the person. Does that help? Still confusing?
No, we were just teasing that out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
That's great. That's really great. What else we got? Yes.
Can I follow that with please? The difference between acceptance and significance?
Yeah, so acceptance.
Being at the top or being viewed as at the top?
No, acceptance is more about I belong. So I belong to this group. I'm one with this group. I'm not necessarily the best of the group. In fact, oftentimes somebody with acceptance does not want to be the best, because then they're going to feel isolated, once again, from the group, because now I'm on a pedestal. Whereas a person with significance entering that group wants to run the group, wants to be the best in the group, viewed as, you know, the top of the group. Yeah, so acceptance is much more like we're equals and you want me with you. Maybe that's a way to phrase it. You kind of want me with you. Significance is I'm above you. In some, if it's in a way that's idolatrous. Make sense? Awesome questions. Yes, sir.
This is all very helpful diagnostic, and maybe I'm getting ahead of where you want to go.
Do it.
But how do we begin to talk to our
people? Oh, yeah. Yeah, so we are definitely going to get there. That's where we're headed. And next week is going to do hopefully a stronger job at it. But one of the things that we want to look at is if you look at these four things. So let me go backwards first. So the goal of fellowship isn't to turn everybody in the room into a counselor, right? It's kind of like, you know, I went to school for almost 3 years. It's like I was like 3,000 pages per class that I had to read. It was like insanity at times, right? Like Grace can tell you that if I sat at my desk in one semester, I had books that were taller than me on both sides of me, and she thought it was for the whole year. And I was like, no, that's just this semester, right? And I'm like not a reader, so I'm ready to cry because it's like all of a sudden I got to read all these books, right? And it's like begging my professors for a video. You know, can I just have one video instead of a book? So we're not trying to do that, but what we're trying to do is show how the Christian body can actually do so much that would put most therapists out of business just by doing some simple things. And some of the simple things just even have to do with the questions we ask people, what we ask them to tell us about, or how we get their story. And so when we start talking about story, and we're going to get there, you're going to see how, like, when I'm listening to somebody's story, how I'm looking for the answers to some of these questions just by how they naturally tell me their story. Because oftentimes, if we're driven by an idol, it just shows up. You just see it because of the description. Especially when we start talking about, let's say, tell me about some of the worst times you've ever had in your life, times that rocked you. What was going on there for you? And typically when we start seeing it, some people will have legitimate traumas that is like, wow, they were abused, they were this, they were that, they were the other. But sometimes when they talk about times that were rocked, it's often because their idol was so threatened that they got so scared. And then you can kind of see it pop out there. But we are definitely heading that way. Great question. Did I see another hand? Yes. Yeah, so for almost all my life, love was my core driver, for sure. And I would say that it's got settled in the fourth year of my marriage. I finally felt love. So one of the reasons why I married Grace was because she was the first person that I really genuinely knew wanted me. She didn't want what I was giving her. She wanted me. And I was like, because I had been longing for that like it's nobody's business. And then it took me a while to get used to that because I didn't have that. I was so uncomfortable with that. And for her, it must have felt maddening. And then eventually, kind of working in the gospel, her showing me love, a couple of my guy friends really showing me love in a way that was really meaningful, especially one guy friend in particular who knew me before even Grace knew me, it just kind of clicked. But then guess what happened around that time? I was adopting these guys. Do you know how expensive it is to adopt a kid? And now much less two of them, right? And what happened then was that Grace and I were going through a really rough time financially, and it was really scary. Like, it got really scary. She got wrongfully terminated from her job. I was just finishing seminary. We barely had, like, if we had enough money at the end of the month to go see a movie during that time, we were like, we can go to a matinee. Like, it was exciting stuff for us, right? So when we were adopting them, my practice was just starting. She lost her job. I freaked out. Like freak out isn't even the right word. Like, you could tell the idol of security more than took over at that point. And then God did something incredible, which is he sent me 15 clients out of nowhere that more than made up her income. Like, more than made up her income. She was celebrating, crying, thanking God profusely. I thanked him and was still angry at him. And that's when I knew that idol was there. And so since then, I've had a battle with security. So the 2008 recession was really scary for us as well. We had to rebuild my practice 4 times in 14 months. It was awful. Scary, scary, scary. Watching friends of mine who do what I do for a living literally losing their homes was awful. But that's part of what got us to Atlanta, was all of that. And so for me, I'm battling security. That's my battle now. And so it has changed. Does it change frequently or in seasons? Typically, no. Typically, it's kind of like one gets settled, and then your heart starts to generate more idols and goes after another one. And usually the circumstances kind of show it to you. So sometimes it'll be a story like mine. I was all about love until this financial crisis hit. Ever since then, it was this. Make sense? Awesome. What other questions we have? These are fantastic. Yes, sir.
I'll just give you a comment with safety. You could make an argument that for most individuals, I'll become a lot more prioritized because obviously, like, as you get older, you start a family, you start having to think about finances a lot more. Another viewpoint as well.
Yeah, so right before I answer this, it's 7:19. If those of you guys need to go to the choir, please do head out, and we're going to wrap this up real fast. You're not going to miss anything too huge, hopefully. So, in some ways, we, like, especially young marrieds, like in that stage when you're just starting to build and starting to grow, security can become a bigger issue. But believe it or not, sometimes all those issues get folded into an existing idol already. It just shows up differently. Usually it's kind of like it becomes more important, like any of these would become more important. Like, so to answer your question a different way, which is kind of tying into what he just said, is some things can become more important to you at a certain stage of life, but not necessarily move to the level of idol. And so that can kind of become more important in different ways, but usually the idol is kind of there. And sometimes it does switch. But we'll know it usually by how somebody manages the threat. That's usually when you know it. We'll know it by what they're pursuing, what they're focused on, and why. That's how we'll know it. And we'll see if it's inordinate or not that way. Awesome. Any other questions before I wrap this up? All right, let's keep going. So this is where we're headed to kind of get towards Carlton's way. So Proverbs 4:23 says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for out of it everything flows." And so when we look at the words there, we have to understand what the heart is. And what the heart is the essence of you. It's not just the essence of your emotions. It's the essence of your emotions, your will, your reason, and your behavior. And to pull it back, it's really talking about your beliefs. In essence, once you believe something, your emotions, your will, your reason, and your behaviors line up to that belief. And that's whether you're conscious of it or not. So the way that I can prove this to you is if I ask each one of you in this room, why did you choose the seat you're sitting in right now? And if you started to describe what led you to that seat, you would suddenly see, oh, I had a belief about that seat. So I'm just making something up right now. I don't know if this is true. The two of you might have said, hey, we really want to see this and be up close. I believe if I sit closer, I'm going to get a better experience with this. People in the back are like, oh man, this is getting a little too touchy-feely. Like, maybe I should hide out back here. And if I hide out back here, maybe this will be easier. Teasing, obviously. Just making it up. But the idea is that everything we do runs on beliefs, and even the most ordinary things run on beliefs. And so we often use a core driver to discover the belief that's running some sort of addictive pattern and behavior or some sort of idol. That's how we often use it. Now, a second component with this that I need to be very clear with, some of us struggle with legitimate either personality disorders or things like that. The core belief will help with those things, but there's other things that typically need to happen. So, for example, I think it was like 18 months ago now, I was diagnosed with CPTSD, complex post-traumatic stress disorder. A psychiatrist tried to diagnose me with PTSD 12 years ago, put me on the medicines, I got worse. It was awful. My grace was like, get off it now. Like, it was like really bad. I became like, I'm a teddy bear normally. I suddenly became angry and ready to fight people. And it's like, that's just so not me, right? So that didn't work. But I didn't know anything about CPTSD. And so because of prolonged trauma, prolonged abuse, I have certain ways that I've dealt with anxiety because I'm really afraid to fully feel it. Because it brings back horrific times that if I talk about to this day, I break down. And when my therapist kind of pushed me into one and really tried to get me to feel it, what he said that I did, which I didn't even realize I did, which is even more freaky. I mean, I'm a therapist. I'm usually pretty aware of what's going on inside of me, right? I better be if I'm doing what I'm doing for a living. He said over Zoom, he said what I started doing was this. And just like crying hysterically while I'm doing this. And what happened in just a quick blip is that one of my stepfathers used to wake me up by closing my nose and my mouth so I couldn't breathe. And he did it almost every day for 9 months. And twice I lost consciousness and thought I was dying. And sometimes what he would do is grab my nose and my mouth with one hand and choke me with the other. So now, and then he's a baseball player, so he had like big, he's a surgeon who was a Dominican League baseball player. And so he had like big, big forearms. I'm 9 years old. I was small for nine. I looked like a six-year-old. And so he would grab my nose and my mouth. I couldn't breathe and then choke me and keep me there. And I would be struggling with everything I had to try to get out. And I couldn't. And I lost consciousness twice. So what happened to me is when I was younger is that if I would ever start to feel anxiety, I would immediately shut down because I was afraid of going back to that place. So now I've got this therapist who's really good in pushing me, and suddenly now I'm freaking out because I feel this incredible anxiety. There is a core belief going on with that. I believe I'm back in that place where I'm being choked, but there's also something that's going on chemically that's happening right now that's part of a personality disorder that I need to deal with in other ways. So we're not trying to address those things. We're really not trying to hit those because typically we do need a lot more training for that. What we want to hit is like the everyday stuff. What we want to hit is how it is that the body can grow. And this kind of stuff, fellowship would even help somebody like me who's gone through what I've gone through. And so we just want to get back to that whole core belief. Is that it? Oh yeah, that's right. We're at the last slide. Any questions about where we're headed? So last thing before we close on prayer is what we want to pay attention to with ourselves or with other people is pay attention to your story. Pay attention to the story of the people you're trying to impact. Their stories typically reveal a lot. Pay attention to the times when they felt the most pain, when they felt rocked. Really pay attention to those times. What was going on for them? How did they experience it? Please do not presume you know, because you might just be inserting your own core driver on them. You have to ask them, what were you going through? What did this represent to you? How did you see this? You need to get in their world, not bring them to your world, if we're really going to have the impact that we want to have in the body of Christ.